I'm an invisible man. No, I am not a spook like those who haunted Edgar Allan Poe, nor am I one of those Hollywood movie ectoplasms. I am a man of substance, of flesh and bone, fiber and liquids, and I might even be said to possess a mind. I am invisible, understand, simply because people refuse to see me. Like the bodiless heads you see sometimes in circus sideshows, it is as though I have been surrounded by mirrors of hard, distorting glass. When they approach me, they see only my surroundings, themselves, or figments of their imagination. Indeed, everything and anything except me.
That's the opening paragraph of Ralph Ellison's 1952 classic, Invisible Man. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
Born in Oklahoma in 1914, Ralph Waldo Ellison lived until he was 80, transforming his love of jazz and his interest in African American history into powerful fiction and essays. How did growing up in an era of Jim Crow segregation affect Ellison? What makes the protagonist of Invisible Man invisible? And why is the novel sometimes called a blues novel or a jazz novel? What is the legacy of Ralph Ellison? Joining us is Craig Werner, professor of Afro-American Studies and Integrated Liberal Studies at the UW-Madison, and the author of books such as Higher Ground and also A Change is Gonna Come, Music, Race, and the Soul of America. Also with us to read passages from Ralph Ellison is UW graduate student Anthony Black.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
When we hear that Ralph Ellison, this major 20th century figure of American literature, was born in Oklahoma, right away things seem to be a little bit skewed. What was it like for Ralph Ellison to be not just born in Oklahoma, a little bit out of the mainstream of what we usually think of as kind of emerging racial consciousness, but also to be named after Ralph Waldo Emerson?
It was a complex fate, to use a term that Ellison himself invoked frequently. Ellison's a very interesting figure in the history of African-American literature and American literature because it's very difficult to place him regionally. Like Mark Twain, parts of Ellison's work are clearly those of a Southern writer, a black man born during the Jim Crow era, who grew up with the shadow of the Tulsa race riots hanging over him in a very, very immediate way. But at the same time, Ellison felt himself to be heir to a tradition of freedom and openness. He felt himself to be part of a frontier sensibility. I talked about the sense of possibility again and again and again. And he had been named after Ralph Waldo Emerson, the transcendentalist philosopher who was a primary theorist of self-reliance. And Ellison's work, in a sense, is a constant struggle, a dialogue, an argument, a song between the realities of oppression, exploitation, white supremacy, and his gut-level belief that art could create a world of freedom and possibility.
What's significant to know about his parents besides that they named him Ralph Waldo?
His mother was very much committed to education. The most important thing about his father, he was a good provider for the families. He died very young with no warning. He died from an anesthetic and an operation gone wrong. And all of a sudden, Ellison and his mother found themselves essentially on the fringes of the black community in Oklahoma City, relying on friends, relying on relatives for support, while his mother worked the life of a black working class woman. So Ellison was both heir to in some ways, very upwardly mobile type of belief in education associated with the black middle class of the time, and increasingly grew up with the reality that he was poor.
Why on the fringes, though, black society in Oklahoma?
On the fringes because they were reliant on family members for economic support. They knew people who were relatively affluent, and what affluent meant for African Americans was different than it would have meant for white folks at the same time. They had all kinds of contact with the black elite of Oklahoma City. That was a good thing for him. He got access to things he wouldn't have had otherwise. But at the same time, was very, very much aware that he didn't have any money. It was very difficult for him to pay for college. He was in and out of Tuskegee because he had trouble paying his tuition.
Of course, we are talking about college here, which would be still pretty unusual, wouldn't
indeed.
It?
Indeed. Indeed.
And what role did music play in his upbringing and development?
Ellison wrote with amazing insight and eloquence about the jazz scene, particularly the territory bands, Jimmy Rushing, Charlie Christian. People grew up in Oklahoma with him, and the jazz bands that played in Kansas City were back and forth between Oklahoma and Missouri and Kansas, and he was immersed in it. It was where he got his sense of artistic discipline. Sometimes the blues were looked at, sometimes jazz even was looked at as a primitive music in a certain sense, the creation of natural geniuses. And Ellison, from sitting in the clubs, hanging around outside the doors of the clubs in Oklahoma City, recognized the fact that these were incredibly disciplined artists.
Now, Tuskegee was actually probably best known for its music department. They had William Dawson, who was one of the foremost of American composers of the time, as the chairman of the music department. We're talking primarily, I'll say, classical music. Yes. In Dawson's case, though, where does this fascination with jazz, you think, start with Ellison? I mean, of course, you have some fantastic music. You have Duke Ellington coming into the foreground by now.
He took the fascination with jazz with him to Tuskegee, where he worked with Dawson. Ellison was a music major at Tuskegee. He wanted to be a trumpet player. He thought that that was his artistic voice when he went there. Turned out it wasn't. But he and Albert Murray, a good friend, an African-American novelist and essayist who was a younger student at Tuskegee, were very much aware of Dawson. They were very much aware of the African-American classical tradition. And in a very basic way, Ellison looked at African-American music, as many musicians and composers did, as music. He didn't draw the same kind of hierarchy. Certainly, as he develops his aesthetic theories of African-American music, he's taking it every bit as seriously as Beethoven or Bach.
And how would Ellison have defined the blues?
Ellison talked about the blues not just as a form, but as a way of working through the complications of experience. Here's the way he defined the blues in his essay, Richard Wright's Blues.
The blues is an impulse to keep the painful details and episodes of a brutal experience alive in one's aching consciousness, to finger its jagged grain, and to transcend it, not by the consolation of philosophy, but by squeezing from it a near-tragic, near-comic lyricism. As a form, the blues is an autobiographical chronicle of personal catastrophe expressed lyrically.
That's a beautiful definition, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's one of the most important aesthetic statements that's ever been made in the United States. I mean, not to overdo it, but I believe that. I think that what Ellison does in that statement is he renders the gap between high art, the kind of thing that Dawson would have been emphasizing in his classes, and vernacular art. Bessie Smith, who he writes about brilliantly, Ma Rainey, Billie Holiday. He renders that gap more or less irrelevant. That for Ellison, what art is about is coping with the most basic challenges of being human. And so he talks about the fact that all of us suffer. He says the blues isn't fingering the jagged grain of a brutal experience. Everybody has those brutal experiences. But what adds the depth and the punch to it is that growing up as a black man during the era of Jim Crow, when segregation was real, when lynching was pervasive in the United States as a mode of social control, when black folk were being treated with terrorism, And that's what it was. The white supremacist terrorist organizations were upon them. That those brutal experiences were unmistakable. You could not run away from them. And they played out, as Ellison knew very well, not primarily in political terms, but in the way that people lived their everyday life. The blues, more than anything else, are about sex and money. And separating the two of them from one another can be tough. Keeping your relationship together when there ain't bread on the table is difficult. But what Ellison does goes beyond that, and he weaves this out in the essay and in other places, but he essentially says that it was almost impossible for black people to deny the reality of suffering. Whereas capitalist, and he had a large socialist influence growing up at that time, whereas capitalist society, materialist society, white society had ways of avoiding, evading, denying the reality of suffering, the blues said you can't do that. It was much harder for black people to ignore the realities of suffering. And so when he says to transcend it, not by the consolation of philosophy, he's saying, don't abstract it. Don't turn it into an idea. Rather, move into it by fingering the jagged grain and by squeezing from it a near tragic, near comic lyricism. And as you think about that term, I think you can keep Beethoven in the back of your head. I think you can keep Brahms in the back of your head. And Ellison knew that music very, very well. And think about near tragic, near comic, that tragedy is when the balance is disrupted and all that's left is waste. Murray and Ellison talked a lot about Shakespeare on this, that Murray said that the blues were black America's answer to Shakespeare's question, to be or not to be. Do you keep on going with it? The Shakespearean comedies end with marriage, with a resolution of balance. The tragedies end with death. And what Ellison says is what the blues do, what great art does, is walks that razor edge between tragedy and comedy, and that's where we are most deeply human. And so the aesthetic theory he derives is in some ways a very, very classical theory. He talks again and again about ritual, about the release of emotion through discipline, through structure. But at the same time, he hears that every bit as much in the juke joint down the street as in the concert hall.
Whereby now it's, 1934, 35, 36, Ellison is well out of college. Is he still in Oklahoma, or is he gravitating towards some center of politics and culture?
He's gravitating wherever he can make ends meet, first of all. Like many, many other young African-Americans who grew up in the wake of the Harlem Renaissance. He was too late for the Harlem Renaissance when he arrives in New York, but he certainly was aware of the cultural ferment that was up there. He never graduated from Tuskegee. He bounced back and forth thinking maybe he'd finish the degree. He went to New York. He went to Cleveland for a while where there were family members. He had a difficult relationship with his brother, but ultimately Ellison was headed for New York City, and he landed in New York City at about the same time, interestingly, that Richard Wright landed in New York City. Sometimes Wright is perceived as being a writer of an older generation because Wright began publishing in his first novel is 1936, Native Son is early 40s, Black Boy is 45, and Ellison doesn't publish till 52. But in fact, there's only a 3-year age difference between them, and they were in the same circles. Ellison, as would become clear later in his career, was a very, very slow writer.
Do you want to compare those two, as long as we've opened that entry to Richard Wright and his famous novel, Native Son, which you think you'd have to call as a tragedy?
Yes. I think that's safe.
The protagonist gets the short end of
it. Ellison and Wright were in some ways very close together at a certain point along the way. But Ellison ultimately believed that art was superior to politics. I don't think there's any other way to say that.
That it didn't have to serve politics.
That it did not have to serve a political end. One of the complications here is that Richard Wright became much more complex later in his life on these issues, too. And once Wright went to France, he became very much involved in existential philosophy, which was very important to Ellison also. But particularly at the time, Wright was viewed by the literary world as somebody who was a political writer, a propagandist. I think that that was a radical simplification of what was actually going on in Wright's work, but that was the way he was set up. And then all other black writers were expected to do the same thing.
Right, protest novels.
Protest writers, yeah. Mm-hmm. And Ellison got involved at a certain point in a very heated, extended argument with the white literary critic Irving Howe over just exactly that issue. Is that Howe basically was arguing that black writers should be political, and Ellison and James Baldwin, also running parallel at the same time, were saying, no, we should have more autonomy as writers. We are serious writers in the same sense that William Faulkner, Ernest Hemingway,
or the writers of the Harlem Renaissance. I mean, they weren't just political writers. There was a great variety there.
Absolutely. And that they were striking blows for artistic freedom, which didn't mean they were apolitical. That there was a politics in the world of any conscious human being, any conscious artist. But Ellison very much felt like he had to struggle to separate his legacy and the way he was perceived from Wright. He made a very meaningful distinction between relatives and ancestors. He says that you, as a writer, you inevitably share characteristics with people who grew up in similar circumstances to you at the similar time. You're in your same family. You're with the relatives, and you're going to sound like them in some way. So there are places where he and Wright sound the same, have the same kinds of concerns. But he said that then you have your ancestors, and you can choose your own ancestors. And what Ellison did was he chose to emphasize some, and I think I would agree with this, would say overemphasize the European side of his ancestry, so that when Ellison looks to Invisible Man, and they ask him questions about that, he was much more likely to cite Dostoevsky.
Well, the, you know, that's the first thing that came to my mind, actually. Dostoevsky, you know, I'm a sick man. I'm a, you know, a very peripheral, marginalized narrator.
You've got a character living in an underground burrow.
Exactly. You have a character who is obviously disaffected and not necessarily 100% followable, if not even necessarily 100% reliable as a narrator.
And absolutely not. And you've got him in a book which carries epigraphs from Melville and T.S. Eliot. But what gets lost in this is that Richard Wright had published a story called The Man Who Lived Underground, which was published in Story Magazine 5 or 6 years before Invisible Man. So the fact that Ellison is an existentialist doesn't necessarily set him aside from Richard Wright. And in fact, Jean-Paul Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir recognized Wright as an existential writer. So what you had here, and what would haunt Ellison throughout his career in a way, was the fact that it was very difficult for him to separate his actual work as an artist from the way that he was situated and perceived within the literary cultures of the time.
And how would he make use of the jazz tradition, particularly the idea of improvisation?
Well, this was Ellison as modernist. And again, he wrote very eloquently on that.
True jazz is an art of individual assertion within and against the group. Each true jazz moment, as distinct from the uninspired commercial performance, springs from a contest in which each artist challenges all the rest. Each solo flight or improvisation represents, like the successive canvases of a painter, a definition of his true identity as individual, as member of the collectivity, and as a link in the chain of tradition. Thus, because jazz finds its very life in an endless improvisation upon traditional materials, the jazz man must lose his identity even as he finds it.
And that is T.S. Eliot's famous essay, Tradition and the Individual Talent, boiled down into a paragraph and recast in relationship to the African-American musical tradition. Another way of saying it is the way Ezra Pound said it, make it new. Take what you've inherited and reinvent it at every step of the way. That's also existential philosophy. But what's really crucial is that where Ellison learned that, and where he learned how that expressed itself in the social life of people who were not part of the cultural elite, was in those jazz clubs in Oklahoma City. That's where he learned what artistic freedom really was.
It's a very interesting smorgasbord of, I'll say, influences on Ralph Ellison, because you talk about the jazz clubs, but you also mentioned T.S. Eliot, and wasn't The Wasteland a really big influence, or at least sort of provide an epiphany for Ellison?
It was a huge influence, and the piece of that story, which is rarely foregrounded in the way it should be, is that one of the major influences structurally and formally on T.S. Eliot was the minstrel show. The various voices in The Wasteland come out, and they come to the center with Mr. Tambo and Mr. Bones, Mr. Interlocutor, the voice in the middle of it. So, again, what that points to is the reality of our cultural interconnectedness that was always at the center of what Ellison was talking about. So the other way to ask that is, to what extent is T.S. Eliot a black writer who we don't look at like that?
Right. So it's that influence bouncing back and forth, in other words. Minstrel show to Eliot, Eliot back to Ellison.
Right. And it's call and response, which is the most fundamental yeah. part of African-American aesthetics. And what Ellison agitated for and asked for throughout his entire career was that we understand this artistic tradition as a political resource, as a way of making democracy real, and that we had the models in our art, and both in the high art and the low art, and that the distinction between those was largely an illusion.
We'll look further at Ralph Ellison, an American original, when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guests are Craig Werner and also, as reader, Anthony Black. We're talking about American giant Ralph Ellison. We wouldn't be talking about Ralph Ellison if it wasn't for Invisible Man. That is sort of his one major work. And, you know, the title really suggests this questioning identity, searching for identity. Can you say something about the title and what Ellison's trying to do?
Yeah. In Invisible Man, Ellison is raising the question of what it means to see and to be seen. On the fundamental level, it's our identity. Who are we to ourselves? Who are we in the world? Who are we in our social interactions with one another? Do black people really see white people? Do white people, more to the point for Ellison, of course, really see black people? Do men really see women? Do women really see men? There are all these questions about how who we are socially gets in the way of our ability to perceive one another. But on a deeper level, there's the question of, are we able to see ourselves? To what extent do those roles we play in the social world get in the way of our seeing ourselves? To what extent does our willingness to look away from the rough sides of our character, the blues moments, our willingness to blame our suffering on other people rather than ask ourselves what we have to do with that? How do all those get in the way? So Invisible Man is the story of a young man from the South who goes on an epic quest. We see him graduate from high school. We see him interact with his family. We see him go away to a college, which is clearly Tuskegee, although Ellison always denied that. He denied almost every single specific connection between Invisible Man and social reality, partially because he wanted to assert the freedom of the work of art from everyday reality. But we see the Invisible Man go to Tuskegee. We see him go north to New York. We see him get a job in a factory in the middle of the labor struggles. We see him immerse himself in Harlem politics. We see him interact with individual ordinary folks in Harlem, particularly his landlady, Mary Rambo. We see him work with an organization called the Brotherhood, at least loosely modeled on the Communist Party, which was very active in Harlem at that time. We see him interact with a character named Ross the Exhorter, who was clearly Marcus Garvey in a literary clothes. We see him discover the underground world of Harlem street hustlers. And at every step of the way, he finds himself recreating his personality to fit into the niche that is offered him. And through it all, he keeps asking him that question, if I'm playing this role, who really am I? And so ultimately, the invisibility that is obvious on the social level is more important as a way of dealing with the question of how do we come to know ourselves.
And he has no name throughout.
And he has no name throughout. He is an invisible man.
A great literary tradition.
Makes him an everyman character. James Baldwin named the protagonist of his greatest short story Sonny, defined only by relationship. The narrator of that one is never named everyman. I mean, you know, there's a long tradition on this. But Ellison spoke about the structure of Invisible Man as being four-leveled. He said that every bit of Invisible Man can be read as a literal narrative, a story about this protagonist, as a symbolic narrative, a narrative in which the protagonist encounters a variety of scenes like, say, Melville and Moby Dick, where everything means something else.
Oh, those English teachers love that, don't they? Keeps them employed for years.
And you can drive people crazy in Invisible Man in exactly the same way. No problem. Symbols all over the place. The Invisible Man picks up a bank that has a thick-lipped caricature of a black, I think it's a mammy figure, you know, cramming money into her mouth. There's an electrified mat on which young black boys are scrambling for what they think is money but turn out to be advertising tokens. There's a symbolic level to it all. But he also argued that there was an allegorical level, and that the allegorical level, most critics have said, Invisible Man is an allegory of the African-American historical passage in the United States. Black people moving from the North, getting education, moving to the South, taking a place away from the South to the North, taking a place at the bottom of the industrial economy, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a story of black life in the United States. But then Ellison, drawing on Dante at this point specifically, says that there's also an anagogic level. And anagogy is the level of literature, philosophy that deals with ultimate realities. And so Ellison drops us, and again, Melville is the person who comes to mind most on this, into a world where all of the social constraints melt away, all of the structures we use to distance ourselves from reality drop away. He finds himself in the prologue of the novel in a strange dream sequence. He's smoked a reefer and he's listening to Louis Armstrong, and there are many, many different record players playing the same record, just slightly out of sync with one another. And he falls into a dream state, I guess you would call it, where he hears this sermon on the nature of a reality. Black is and black ain't. Black will get you and black won't. Black do and black don't. And it's all of those just deep contradictions of experience. And so there's a profoundly philosophical level that you can, if you choose to, read through each level of Invisible Man, each scene of Invisible Man. And that's why when Bookworld magazine, one of the leading literary magazines, newspapers of New York, in 1965, I believe it was, polled American literary critics, people like Leslie Fiedler and R.W.B. Lewis, the A-list of American literary critics and writers, on the most important novel of the post-war era. Invisible Man was first, ahead of all the novels of Saul Bellow, who had like half the rest of the top 10, and Bernard Malamud and Carson McCullers and Flannery O'Connor. Invisible Man was first, and that has been borne out in subsequent polls of that sort with fair regularity. Invisible Man exerted an immense impact, in part because of that multi-leveled valence to the narrative.
What do you make of the fact that he's underground, but with all these light bulbs on?
That 1,369 of them, actually.
That's symbolic, that
yes.
Number?
Yeah. That number comes from a Harlem Dream book at the time, that there was this basically lottery in black communities that was off the books, but there were numbers runners, you know, part of the underground economy, where you would bet on what the last numbers of the numbers of shares sold on the New York Stock Exchange. There were some variations on it, but that was the most frequent one. Each day were going to be, and you could put in, you could bet your number, and you could bet however many numbers you wanted, and the odds went up the more numbers you had on it. And there were all kinds of dream books that said, if you dream this, here is what number you should bet. And there's a dream book that somebody turned up in which 1369 is what you should bet if you dream of being invisible.
Okay.
So there you go. But on a more deep, on a more basic level, I think that what Ellison is saying is in order to see yourself, you have to withdraw from humanity. You have to withdraw from the social world into a place of what the African-American critic Robert Steptoe called hibernation. He said that the invisible man is hibernating so that he can reflect on his experience and come to know who he was. And this, of course, is what the artist does for Ellison, is that the artist is the one who thinks about themselves. So Invisible Man as a novel is obviously a Bildungsroman, to use the technical term.
The character develops.
Yeah, the development of the young character, usually a young man from the provinces who comes to the city to discover who he is. The variation of the Bildungsroman is called the Künstlerroman, which is the novel of the development of the artist. And Invisible Man is probably better seen as the development of the artist, the invisible man going through all these experiences. And he carries around symbols of each stage in his briefcase he's been given. And when he first tumbles into his underground burrow, he gets his light by burning those symbols of his past experience. And then he learns how to siphon power out from United Monopolated, I believe the company is. And so he's running a little underground artistic guerrilla compound here.
Well, I suppose with all the lights on, it suggests enlightenment, too, and seeing.
Yes.
In other words, he's hibernating, but not in a cave, not in darkness.
Right. And he explicitly says near the end of the novel that a hibernation is a preparation for more overt action.
Give us some examples in that novel of his invisibility and his encounters with other people. And I suppose ultimately, of course, he's invisible to himself until he starts to discover himself through these experiences.
It happens at every step of the way. The first chapter of Invisible Man, which is frequently excerpted in literary anthologies, is called the Battle Royal chapter. And in this, the Invisible Man is a high school valedictorian from the black high school in the small southern town where he is living. And he's invited to a celebration of the local Rotary Club, essentially. Apologies to the Rotary Club. The local white businessmen's organization invites him. They're going to give him a college scholarship, and he thinks he's going to deliver a speech. He ultimately delivers Booker T. Washington's Atlanta Exposition address, which has its own ironies to it. But rather than deliver the speech first, he is blindfolded and put in a ring with a bunch of other young black men who are just beating the hell out of each other, boxing gloves. And in that situation, the invisible man is literally not seen as a young intellectual. He is seen as another one of these black boys sent there to beat each other up. Similar situations play out over the course of the novel. He goes to the black college based on Tuskegee, and the president of the college sees him not as a promising young intellectual, but as a threat to the stability of the university, and sends him on his way. So at every step of the way, there's a dissonance between who the invisible man thinks he is and what he's being treated like.
What about the grandfather in this novel?
Well, the whole pattern of Invisible Man is set in motion by advice that the invisible man is given by his grandfather.
He was an odd old guy, my grandfather, and I'm told I take after him. It was he who caused the trouble. On his deathbed, he called my father to him and said, "Son, after I'm gone, I want you to keep up the good fight. I never told you, but our life is a war, and I've been a traitor all my born days, a spy in the enemy's country ever since I gave up my gun back in the Reconstruction. Live with your head in the lion's mouth. I want you to overcome him with yeses and undermine him with grins. Agree him to death and destruction. Let him swallow you till they vomit or bust wide open." They thought the old man had gone out of his mind. He had been the meekest of men. The younger children were rushed from the room, the shades drawn, and flames of the lamp turned so low that it sputtered on the wick like the old man's breathing. Learn it to the youngins, he whispered fiercely. Then he died.
Ambiguous advice at the very, very best. And the Invisible Man is haunted by that throughout the novel, that he's trying to figure out what his grandfather could conceivably have meant by that. On one level, it's a fairly clear statement of one of the most fundamental African-American survival strategies, which is masking, which is putting on an agreeable face to those who have power over you, to protect yourself from attack, to diffuse any kind of criticism, whereas at the same time, that can free you to go about your subversive strategies behind the mask. So the grandfather is, when he says, overcome him with yeses, undermine him with grins, agree him to death and destruction, let him swallow you till they vomit or bust wide open. He's simply saying mask, you know, hide who you are, like that. But what's tricky about it in context is at this point, the Invisible Man is a good young student. He has been doing what he's been told to do. He thinks that's the right thing. He believes in the system. He's going to do that. He's going to succeed. And his grandfather, who everybody thought was meek, right, an agreeable guy who gave up his gun, right, who wasn't a fighter, is all of a sudden telling him to subvert things, to play the game. And the Invisible Man is absolutely confused by what this means. And over the course of the novel, he keeps encountering figures who echo the grandfather's advice in one way or another. He meets a veteran who is in a mental asylum, who has been called crazy, but who is probably one of the most insightful people in the book, who basically cites, repeats the grandfather's advice. He said, man, don't be so dumb as to think that what they're offering you is reality, is actual reality. And then he goes on and talks about it as a Renaissance game, essentially talking about Machiavelli. He says that what we're dealing with is ultimate power thing. And the Invisible Man, yet again, doesn't have a clue what he's being told. He runs into this very strange cat in Harlem who's got a push cart full of blueprints, old blueprints on it, and he's Petey Wheatstraw, the devil's son-in-law, riffing off some old blues lines on that. But there's a sense that somebody's got the plans there on the street, and all of the figures who really understand what's going on in the social world are in some ways marginalized from it. They're the grandfather, they're the crazy veteran, they're this dude with the blueprints, there are this incredibly interesting group of zoot suiters later on when he runs into in Harlem, encounters these guys on the street. He's been working with the Communist Party, which is very scientific in its rhetoric about itself.
Oh, yes.
And he's out on the street, and he encounters something he's not expecting to see.
They've been there all along, but somehow I'd missed them. I'd missed them even when the work had been most successful. They were outside the groove of history, and it was my job to get them in, all of them. I looked into the design of their faces, hardly a one that was unlike someone I'd known down south. Forgotten names sang through my head like forgotten scenes and dreams. I moved with the crowd, the sweat pouring off me, listening to the grinding roar of traffic, the growing sound of a record shop loudspeaker blaring a languid blues. I stopped. Was this all that would be recorded? Was this the only true history of the times, a mood blared by trumpets, trombones, saxophones and drums, a song with turgid, inadequate words?
And that's another one of those moments when the Invisible Man is hearing something, sensing something. Something's coming into his consciousness that disrupts what he thinks he believes. He thinks that his job is to reduce this all to Marxist ideology, to make it scientific, to control it, and to direct that social energy. And it's like any activist runs into. You get the demonstration going. You get people all together. And then you look out at the side and you say, yeah, but there are a bunch of people over there on the edge that kind of ought to be here, but they aren't. They're doing their own thing. Civil rights activists talked about it as the shadow march. They said that outside the march, there was always a group of people milling along the outside of it, frequently armed in the nonviolent march. But what the invisible man, what Ellison keeps doing is he keeps pointing to there. He says, out there, beyond my understanding, beyond the invisible man's understanding, there is a voice that's saying something else. I think this particular passage was motivated in part by bebop, which would have been the new jazz of the time. Ellison loved Count Basie. He loved Duke Ellington. He loved the classical kind of jazz. And then he got this ragged rhythm, and he got these cats who were dressing strange and who weren't political in what they were doing or weren't obviously political. And there's always that sense from the grandfather on that there's something eluding his consciousness and that it can't be reduced to black nationalism, it can't be reduced to socialism, it can't be reduced to any of the ideologies that are used to distance us from our experience. And that's why he keeps going back to the blues. He keeps saying, go into the actual experience. Get as deeply in to the unmediated, which is always an illusion, but to the extent you can, get into your experience as deeply as you can without letting somebody else's definitions get in the way.
So is he saying in the book, An Invisible Man, in the long run, that language really does not pin down this elusive experience? He's saying that you might have a communist framework, you might have a capitalist framework, you might have some other kind of framework, a point of reference and all that, but the minute you start to sort of smooth this away with language, you're losing the reality of it.
It's interesting. He has a very complex relationship with language because language is at once the impediment and the path to freedom. It's in the artistic language. It's in the jazz-inflected language, particularly the blues-grounded, jazz-inflected language. The blues can point to those clear realities, those lived realities that the ideological language gets in the way of.
And that maybe music, better than words, can convey that experience.
I think that Ellison, like many other African-American writers, was reaching towards music with what he did. He was also fascinated by the visual arts. He loved Romare Bearden's work, and I think that he felt that Bearden reached something that was difficult to impossible to reach.
And he had these collages.
The collages, yeah, beautiful, multi-dimensional collages, many of them collages based on music. That he has beautiful, beautiful jazz sequence. And Ellison wrote the catalog for one of the major Bearden retrospectives in the 1980s. But yes, there's always that sense. And again, this is so typically high modernist in where it comes from, of reaching for a form of expression which moves beyond convention. In the definition of the jazz impulse, which Anthony read a while back, he says, as distinct from the uninspired commercial performance.
Yes,
right? True jazz is distinct from the kind of literature, that kind of music that is domesticated.
It's living, it's not set in stone.
Exactly. And when, language can do that also for Ellison.
And when the novel ends and we're in the same place that it began, where he's still with the light bulbs and he's still in the same place, what's changed?
Well, in some ways, nothing. It's a circular pattern. But in other ways, everything. It's important to register The Invisible Man starts with a prologue, which takes place after all of the action of the novel. And then it returns to the underground at the end. It returns to his burrow at the end. And at that point, The Invisible Man, what's changed is his consciousness, his understanding of who he is, his ability to see himself. And in a very beautiful passage from near the end of the novel, he talks about that.
The very act of trying to put it all down has confused me and negated some of the anger and some of the bitterness. So it is that now I denounce and defend, or feel prepared to defend. I condemn and affirm, say no and say yes, say yes and say no. I denounce because, though implicated and partially responsible, I have been hurt to the point of abysmal pain, hurt to the point of invisibility. And I defend because, in spite of all, I find that I love. In order to get some of it down, I have to love. I sell you no phony forgiveness. I'm a desperate man. But too much of your life will be lost, its meaning lost, unless you approach it as much through love as through hate. So I approach it through division. So I denounce and I defend and I hate and I love.
It's dense, to say the least. But I think what he's done and what he's learned and what's changed is that he's accepted the ambiguity of experience rather than trying to domesticate it, rather than trying to tame it. He now embraces the near tragic, near comic elements of it. It's both sides, not an either or, and that to move ahead demands accepting that.
We'll follow Ralph Ellison beyond Invisible Man with a few final thoughts in a moment. This is University of the Air.
So my task was one of revealing the human universals hidden within the plight of one who was both black and American, and not only as a means of conveying my personal vision of possibility, but as a way of dealing with the sheer rhetorical challenge involved in communicating across our barriers of race and religion, class, color, and region, barriers which consist of the many strategies of division that were designed and still function to prevent what would otherwise have been a more or less natural recognition of the reality of black and white fraternity.
That's from the introduction to the 30th anniversary edition of Ralph Ellison's book, Invisible Man, as read by Anthony Black, who is with us, as is Craig Werner. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Air. We have dwelt for a while in this complex book that can be read on four different levels, Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison, published in 1952. And what else is there after that, though? I mean, you have a man with a lot of experience in life and a lot of interests, a lot of diversity, and some really intense writing.
Yeah, it's been said that there are no second acts in American literature, and never truer than in Ellison's case. Ellison, over the last almost 40 years of his life, published a number of essays, a very influential book of essays called Shadow and Act, which he theorizes American literature and African-American literature, a second book of essays called Going to the Territories, some collections of early short stories. But the centerpiece of his life was what wasn't published, and that was his second novel. A piece of it was published as Juneteenth. More recently, a large version has been published under the title 3 Days Before the Shooting, which extends more than 1,000 pages, some of which is finished, some of which is nearly finished, some of which is very fragmentary. Ellison had various demons to battle. Part of it was that Invisible Man was so successful so early. It didn't catch on immediately, but it caught on quickly. And by the time his second novel was expected, the standard was so high, and he was such a perfectionist that he had trouble letting loose of anything. By all accounts, he was close to having a version of something that he was going to publish in the middle 1960s, and that's already more than 10 years after Invisible Man, when he had a house fire that burned down a vacation house in Massachusetts and destroyed part of the manuscript. Now, at the time, Ellison said that it destroyed the whole manuscript. It turns out, in retrospect, that's very unlikely.
So it was an excuse,
happened.
Then?
It seems to have been an excuse. Ellison was in a difficult political position. By sensibility, he was a classical liberal, classical conservative, if you want to go deeply into the political sense of it, but he was a supporter of the Kennedy administration, of the Johnson administration, of Adlai Stevenson, of the Democratic mainstream, of the mainstream of the civil rights movement. And by the time that he began to think about publishing again, by the time that became an issue, it was the rise of the Black Power movement and the Black Arts Movement, a young group of writers, Amiri Baraka, probably the most prominent amongst them, who were arguing for a kind of black writing that was unconcerned with white people, that was repudiating the Western tradition that was in the air Ellison breathed. They looked at him as a sellout. They looked at him as somebody who was in collaboration with the Johnson administration during the Vietnam War. They looked at him as someone who was willing to accept the position of official Negro writer, as the one whose status was based on the fact that he was different from the rest of them. And Ellison had at the very best a spotty record of supporting younger black writers. Mostly, he didn't.
And that was because why?
He would say because it was a matter of literary quality and artistic quality, and that was all that mattered, and race was not a factor of that. But along the way, his judgment was bad, if that was what he was doing, that there were younger writers who clearly were first-rate writers who he didn't have the time of day for. Also, he was a member of a number of social clubs in New York and was involved in keeping the doors of them shut against women. The entry of women. I mean, it's not a pretty story in some ways.
So he lost that edge that he was talking about before.
It's arguable.
That ragged edge.
At the same time, when you sit down and actually read the material included in 3 days before the shooting, some of it is brilliant. Some of it is as good as the best that Ellison ever wrote. I think the version that was excerpted as Juneteenth is bad, frankly. I think that it played to the worst part of Ellison's tendency towards pontificating at times. But I think that it's not hard to imagine a great, great novel having emerged from 3 days before the shooting. And I think it's worth the struggle for anybody who's seriously interested in African-American literature. It'll never find a wide readership.
It's interesting that it focuses on a senator who's a racist senator who seems to have a past that would suggest he has some African-American ancestry.
Yeah, it's somebody who is racially ambiguous, but he grew up black, becomes a racist senator, and the book actually begins with his being shot on the floor of the Senate. And part of Ellison's problem, one of the many things that paralyzed him, and or excuses, depending on how charitable one is being, is he's was writing this during the era of the assassinations of Kennedy and Malcolm and Martin Luther King. And at a certain point, he said, it's going to sound like I was copying reality. Whereas when he wrote that piece of it, it was prior to the assassinations. So he paralyzed himself. He absolutely paralyzed himself as a writer of fiction. And I think it's just an immense tragedy. Subsequently, what happened with Ellison is the best of the black arts critics, the radical black critics, a young man named Larry Neal, who tragically died young, wrote an essay called Ellison's Zoot Suit, where he told the rest of the young black writers, he said, hang on a minute. I don't care whether Ellison agrees with your politics or not. Read the book. He said, there's more political power, there's more subversive power in Invisible Man than in a month of soapbox speeches. And he said, use this. This is where our tradition has come in to a centerpiece. And today, Ellison is all but universally recognized as a positive, wonderful, nurturing, generative figure.
Our guests today have been Craig Werner and reading the words of Ralph Ellison, Anthony Black. Thanks for being with us. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach. I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air. Next Sunday afternoon at 4 during University of the Air, Catherine Kautsky will be at the keyboard with us, sharing insights into one of the world's most original composers. His name, Claude Debussy. We'll look into his preludes. Join us right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.